Okay, I would like to please welcome our speaker this afternoon, Joe C. from Palm Beach, Palm Coast, Florida. There you go, Joe.
Thank you. I appreciate it. All right. It's great to be here. It's an honor to be the kickoff speaker for this unconvention. My name's Joe Krogan. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you for inviting me, the committee, whoever's responsible for it. And we're gonna try and have a little fun tonight. My home group is Life's a Beach that meets in Palm Coast, Florida. My sobriety date is September 12th, 1990. And you know, when we read, I think it was Cheryl that read that part in the big book and talked about we're like men who have lost their legs. We never grow new ones. But I found that we do grow wings in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you stick around long enough, I don't know if there's any new people in this room. I'm sure there are. If there's good sponsorship, there's new people here. You're dragging your sponsees here. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't always feel that way. I don't know if my story is like yours. I'm going to try and, you know, truthfully, I have no clue what I'm going to say tonight or where this is going to go, but it's always an honor and a privilege to be at an AA meeting. And the Zoom format is so, it's still kind of unusual. You know, I wish it was a real convention so I could have been invited to come out there to San Fernando Valley and be with y'all. That would have been great. But I get to help my wife with the dishes after this meeting's over. So, you know, it's kind of a little bit of a letdown. Of course, she doesn't think so. And I love AA because this is the only society where I would have truly fit in. We're like no other society. When we get together, if you listen to the conversations before a meeting, it's not like normal people getting together at a cocktail party. Our conversations are, oh, where are you from? I'm from Palm Coast. Oh, I got arrested there. You know, you don't say that in normal company or at the church group or the PTA. But that's where I got my fifth DUI. No kidding. That's great. Would you talk at our meeting next week? So we're kind of an unusual society. And I thank God I found a place I fit in. You know, it reminds me of a story. I was working with a new guy, a sponsee. Now, I don't know if you have Waffle House in California. Do you have Waffle House? You do? Oh, great. Then Waffle House is like this little diner. It's at a counter. They cook your eggs and breakfast right there behind the counter and then serve it to you. It's a very, you know, kind of go there at 3 in the morning, drunk, have a steak and eggs and a pecan waffle, and that was your drunk breakfast there. But I still go to Waffle House, and I was meeting a new guy, and it's really a very kind of cheap breakfast. And the waitresses there really work hard, and they're trying to turn their tables and make some money. I went there to meet a new guy, and he didn't show up. He was late. And I'm taking a table on a Saturday morning, and the waitress is getting a little bit irritated because this is, you know, these are the type of people that they've got to work for a living. They probably got 4 kids at home, no insurance. You know, it's a hard job. And what happened was he finally shows up. The sponsee finally shows up and he sits down with me. By this time, the waitress is a little bit aggravated. She comes over to the table. Do you know what you want? And, you know, he got a little perturbed. He was a new guy. So he still, you know, had his, you know, righteous indignation. And, you know, he gave her a look and he made his order and we ate breakfast and we left. And when she dropped the check, you know, I knew we had taken her time and she could have turned this table 2 or 3 times. So the check was like, whatever the check was, I don't know, $10, $12. I left her the equivalent in a tip. This new guy looks down and he says, you know, I was brought up where we don't reward bad behavior. And I said, really? Well, thank God Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't practice that. And so if you're in this meeting, and I love AA, you know, I love people that come to meetings. I just spoke at a detox last night and, you know, there was a person in there goes, I came here on my own. I got a tip for you. Nobody comes here on their own. This is gun to the head recovery. Alcoholics Anonymous is the last on the list of things I'm going to try. Okay. And now I'm not here to tell you you're alcoholic. I'm here to tell you I'm one. I'm not an expert on AA. I'm not a teacher of the big book or the steps. What I am is a satisfied customer of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what you are is part of the wholesale miracles that Bill talked about. So I love being around you. And these are great events when you get to be there live, because most of you are people celebrating your recovery. And it's fun to be around. And we have a lot of fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor used to say, if you don't find a way to get high on your recovery, you're going to get high on something else. And this is part of the way we get high together when we do these things. I am an alcoholic as described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I need to check the time, because you people really cut into my time there with all that reading and announcements. But that's okay. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, we're so funny. And if you don't end on time, you know, you couldn't kick us out of a bar, right? I mean, we'd be in the bar at closing time. You can't get rid of us. Please, can I get one more? But in an AA meeting, when it's over, you're going, Jesus could be speaking, and people are going, Lord, let's go, cut it. All right. We're a funny group of people. I love us. So I got to make sure of the time when I started and when I get to finish. Bob, if you would be so kind as give me the hook when it's over. Thank you. And but I'm an alcoholic as described in the big book. I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And I know the book talks about the many different kinds of alcoholic. It talks about the kind that the alcoholic who is unable to admit that he can't stop drinking on his own. Then the other alcoholic, it talks about it, describe the person who thinks he can drink normally after a period of abstinence. It talks about the person who's normal in every respect except for his drinking. That's not me. Okay. Then it mentions me, the psychopath. And that's the guy who makes many resolutions, but never a decision. Always quitting. I was always going on the wagon, you know. And now I'm not going to talk about the first 10 years. The first 10 years of my drinking were great. That's what got me here, because I was trying to recreate that first 10 years for another 10 years. I wasn't very successful at it. And by the time I got here, there was nobody left in my life. Nobody, the only people left in my life, were the ones willing to forgive me. There was nobody that was unhurt by my alcoholism. And I, you know, I was so unaware of it. I got here on September 12th, 1990, was 5 days before my 40th birthday. I'd never been to an AA meeting, never been to a treatment center or a detox. I wish I would have known about those things. I take meetings into them every week. I wish I would have known there was a place. Those are like Jiffy Lubes for AA. You know, they take the new guy, you go in, they feed you, they clothe you, they get you sober for, you know, they fatten you up, and it's like lube oil filter, rotate the tires, now you're good for another 20,000 miles. If I would have known places like that, I'd probably be dead. And yet people still say, oh, well, you were a one-chip wonder. No, I wasn't. Those last 10 years, there's a line in our book that caught my attention. Bill says, the remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the morning after are unforgettable. And that's what got me here, was the remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the morning after, the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. But anyway, I don't remember, and I'll tell you how I'll do my drunkalog. It's a real short drunkalog, because I don't need to bore you. We all know how to drink and drink. And I always, right from the very beginning, when I drank, I always overshot the mark. I would drink, and I was baffled. I didn't know, why do I always drink till I throw up? And luckily, I discovered there's medication for that. And I don't throw, and the medication is called cocaine. And I didn't throw up anymore And I was, so for my very first time drinking, and now listen, I apologize if there's any old timers here that have never done any drugs. Too bad, it's too late. Because I find alcoholics like drugs, okay? And if you're not aware of that, it might trip you up later on in life when you have some surgeries, because I've seen it happen to many of us over and over again, but that's another issue. So I don't remember. Here's how I drank. Real simple. I don't stop. I run out. I don't know how you drink, but that's how I drink. Now, I didn't know what that was. I didn't know that there's a name for that. They call it the phenomenon of craving. I had no idea. I never went to the bar and said, listen, give me two drinks. Oh, better give me another one because I'm starting to have the phenomenon of craving. I never told my dope dealer that. And if you're in an AA meeting, listen, I love, my sponsor used to say, if you're here, we know why you're here. He said, if you see a guy riding a bicycle, smoking a cigarette, you know, he's not doing it for a workout. But I came to AA, I wanted to be the coolest guy in the room. I was just having a hard time proving it, okay? I was 40 years old and I had lost everything. So the other way I drink is I don't stop, I get caught. Something has to happen to stop me. The blue lights in the rearview mirror, she throws me out, I have to lose a job. Something has to happen in my life that causes me some pain. And it's real easy to be remorseful in the back of a cop car. I'm sure some of you know that. And that's what would happen to me. And I would get remorseful. And I thought, like the big book says, armed with a firm desire, a firm resolution not to do this again, and that's what I would do. I would come to and have this firm resolution, but I would do it over and over and over again. My sponsor gave me the test early on. He said, I'll give you the test. He said, have you ever woke up after a binge? I'm a binge drinker. And said, that's it, I'm done. I'm going to straighten my life out. I go, yeah. He said, well, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. He said, have you ever drank after you said that? Yeah. He goes, well, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. Now, the next question may, more than once? Hundreds of times. And don't know how I go from 8 o'clock in the morning, swear to God, I'm not going to do this anymore, to probably, and at the end, it was only a few hours. How in the hell did I start drinking again? And I didn't know. I had no clue what alcoholism looked like. I had no clue what the symptoms were. Why was I doing this? I don't drink at lunch because when I drink at lunch, I don't go back to work. From the very start, I was in pursuit of the perfect high. I don't have a drink with dinner because if I'm drinking tonight, I'm fasting. I'm not eating. Drinking is the main objective. This is how I drank right from the very start and did other things. I was in Miami. I moved to Miami and when I was 18 years old to go to college. I never went to college. I only enrolled in college. Okay. Cause drinking and drugs were always the big deal. And I was in Miami in the early 70s. And I remember, back when there for the snowstorms and the blizzards of the early 70s in Miami. I remember reading an article and it talks about in our book, it says that when you start to drink, if you can't control the amounts you drink, or if you try to, when you stop, you can't quit entirely, you may be alcoholic. Okay, I have those two symptoms. But then the bad news, if this be the case, you're suffering from an illness, which only singular, a spiritual experience will conquer. Well, I didn't come here for a spiritual experience. Matter of fact, I didn't come here to quit drinking or using drugs, to tell you the truth. And you're going to hear, maybe my story's a little different. I did not wake up and go, whew, that's enough. I'm coming up on my 40th birthday, time to quit. That's not my story. But back in those days, I remember I loved getting high so much in the drinking and the party life. And there was an article that came out in a Time magazine. It was called Paradise Lost. And it was about South Florida and all the drugs and the drinking and the lifestyle. And in that article, they defined the effect of alcohol and drugs on a drug addict and alcoholic. And here's what it said. Because I couldn't figure, why do I like it so much? What is this thing it does for me? Because it does for me. Eventually, it does to me. But in the beginning, it does for me something and I can't put my finger on it. And they defined it. It says it creates a sense of well-being. I'm just good enough. I'm just okay. Everything else is just okay. It's good enough. Now, I don't remember a hell of a lot about September 12th, my sobriety date. I remember a hell of a lot about September 11th, the day before my sobriety date. That was a bad day. Perhaps you guys remember the day before you got here. I guarantee it was a bad day for most of us. And I had been, let me tell you what it looked like, because this is what happened. And it never, these were the last days of my drinking, the last few months. This was the really dark time in my life. I was living in a Skid Row motel room in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, with my two-year-old son and his mom. And I'd never planned on ending up in a place like this or a lifestyle like that. And in those days, this is what used to happen. Like I said, I'd wake up in the morning, swear to God, I'm going to change my life, get us out, and make a firm resolution not to do it again. And the next thing you know, I'm drinking or high again one more time. And I would come to from a binge, and this used to happen in that motel room quite often. I was in there for at least two to three months. I would come to, maybe some of you remember this feeling, after a binge, when you would crack your eyelids open and come to. And the first thought in my mind was, damn, I'm not dead. Now, I wasn't suicidal, but I did not want to wake up in my life anymore. I was trapped in a life that was absolutely unbearable. And when I would, and then the horror would be on you, because you'd look around and it's, you're in this motel room and it's all gone. The booze is gone, the dope's gone, the money's gone. One more time, it's all gone. And then I would do what I call the alcoholic dance. I would walk over to the crib where my little boy was. And by the way, I love that little boy. I was there 2 years earlier when he was born, and I had a job and things were different. And I remember being at the hospital when that little boy was born. I picked him up and held him in my arms and I cried like a baby. For the first time in my life, I fell in love with another human being. It was like somebody flicked a switch in my life. I looked at that little boy and I made him all the promises that a dad probably makes his son. I said, you're going to know you're loved. I'm going to show you how to play baseball, basketball, football. We're going to be able to walk down the street arm in arm and hold each other. We're going to be able to tell each other we love each other. And I meant it from the bottom of my heart. And I have never fallen in love with another person like I'd fallen in love with that little boy. Instantly. And I set that little boy down in the crib in the nursery, and I walked out to the waiting room. And there was a friend of mine, and he said, let's go have a drink to celebrate the birth of your son. 8 days later, I showed up. I don't even know how they got home from the hospital. See, because when I drink, that's what I do. I drink. I don't do anything else. I told you that's why I don't drink at lunch. I don't go back to work. And that's one of the strongest desires in the world. I thought that little boy was going to, the love of that child would straighten me out. You know, maybe this will straighten me out, having a son. And they talks about it in the book, No Human Power. Well, that was the final straw. No human power could relieve my alcoholism. There was nothing else in my life. There was legal problems that didn't stop me. There was financial problems that didn't stop me. There was relationship problems. Maybe some of you have had all these problems. That didn't stop me. There was health problems. I came close to dying. At the end of my drinking, I had sores all over my body. I had a staph infection. My teeth were falling out of my head. And it still couldn't stop me. As a matter of fact, I had to drink to kill the pain. But the emotional pain, the pain of a wasted life, the pain of broken relationships was so unbearable. And I still couldn't figure out what the problem was. So I would stumble over. I would do the alcoholic dance. I would stumble over in that motel room to the crib. And if child welfare services would have walked in that motel room, I would be in jail. And I love, this is how I treat someone I love more than anything in the world. He was in that crib in filthy diapers, and he had a bottle that used to have milk in it, but it barely was cloudy water. And if I could have convinced you to give me $20 to go buy milk and diapers, I would have meant it when I borrowed the money. But the moment you put that money in my hand, I have a psychic change. Something comes over me. And I said, yeah, but you know what? Maybe let me just go get a six pack. Let me just go get one rock. I can get another 20 somewhere. And I would be off to the races again. And then doing the same thing again, cracking my eyelids open. Damn, I'm not dead. Go over to the crib. I'm going to get us out of here. I'm going to turn my life around. I'm going to be a dad. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to pay the bills. See, I don't understand that doing that, there's a line in our book that explains it. I don't understand this. I didn't know, never been to, around you people. It says there's a point in the drinking of every alcoholic when the strongest desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. Luckily, my sponsor explained that to me. He said, wanting to stop drinking has no effect on stopping drinking. I thought you had to want to stop. See, I wanted God to do the heavy lifting. Please, God, make me want to stop. If he made me want to stop, it wouldn't be any big deal, right? I just would stop. But he never did that. See, I thought you had to want to stop, and I didn't know that. We say at meetings all the time, you hear it all the time, you never have to take another drink again if you don't want to. Well, that was crap. But what we really should say is you never have to take another drink again, even if you want to. Because I found out for me, Alcoholics Anonymous, it may be different for you, but for me, it's not a place where I came to quit drinking. Alcoholics Anonymous is a place for people who can't quit drinking. And luckily, I was made aware of that. And let me tell you what happened to me on September 11th, why things were different. Because I had done that dozens and dozens of times, come to from a binge, crack my eyelids open, the same thing. And on September 11th, this is what was different. I cracked my eyelids open. Damn, I'm not dead. I was in the filth and squalor of that Skid Row motel room, and it was all gone. The booze was gone. The money was gone. The drugs were gone. One more time. I walked over to the crib, started to cry again, looked at my little boy in that crib, and I said, that's it. I'm done. I'm going to get us out of here. And the moment I said that, there was a voice inside my head as clear as my voice tonight. And here's what it said. No, you're not. And for the first time in my life, I understood what my problem was. Now, listen carefully, because my problem was not alcohol or drugs. My problem was not enough alcohol or drugs. See, if I could have stayed drunk and high, I wouldn't be here tonight. I wouldn't need you. My problem was sobering up. And for the first time in my life, I understood it. It's untreated sobriety. And that day, I made a decision. There was no more resolutions. And it's the first time I've made a decision. And the decision, now it's going to sound crazy, but I said, I'm never going to wake up and feel guilt, shame, and remorse again. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And you know what? I'm going to quit quitting. I'm done. I'm not going to, this is who I am. It's like falling out of a skyscraper. On your way down, you go, So this is how it ends. That morning, I knew, so this is how it ends. So this is how I'm going to die, a drunk, in the gutter, or in jail. And I made a decision that I'm going to do from that moment on whatever it takes to just finish it off as quickly as I can. And there, believe it or not, there was actually some peace about that decision. Because for the first time in my life, I didn't have to pretend to be something I wasn't. Now, I didn't know until I got here later that, so I didn't come to you to stop drinking. I surrendered to alcoholism on September 11th, 1990. And if you read the book in Bill's story, now I didn't see this until quite a while later after I was sober, because I'm that type of guy. My sponsor gave me a big book. I said, no, I'm not a reader, but thank you anyway. I thought that was a good reason not to read the book. So, what happens is, in Bill's story, he said, so this is the end, the curtain. He said, so I was to go on joining the endless procession of sots that had gone on before me. How dark it is before the dawn. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I'd met my match. Alcohol was my master. Now, it doesn't sound like he surrendered to get sober. And that's right before, that sounds like a bottom to me. And that's, sounds like he was surrendered like I was, or had a similar experience. Now, I didn't know that. Now, how did that end up that day I decided to drink until I die? How did that end up being my last? Well, that's where my best thinking, I never woke up one time and said to myself, I'm going to burn my life to the ground. Every day I woke up and I said, today I'm going to be as happy and as successful as I possibly can. Even if it just meant getting a six pack or going to get a 50. If, you know, I never planned on blowing my life or burning it to the ground. So my best effort, the best ability I had, took me to a Skid Row motel room 5 days before my 40th birthday. That's where, and I finally knew it. And I finally surrendered to this disease. So this is it. Now that's where I took me. Now let me tell you where God took me. And I choose it to be God because Bill gives us a choice. He's either everything or he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. What's your choice to be? You want a world without God? Have at it. I lived in one for almost 40 years. And you know what? I came to believe because I saw it in your lives. And this is where God, and I didn't happen to me overnight, but this is where God showed up in my life. He talks about the flimsy reed. It talks about it in the 12 and 12 that we warped our mind to such an obsession for drinking that only an act of providence could solve our problem. And an act of providence is an act of God. Now, I didn't know it was an act of providence at the time it happened. I didn't know that it was the flimsy reed being held out to me. The flimsy reed's being held out while you're in the quicksand, right? And what happened that night on September 11th, there was a knock on the motel room door. Now, any of you that drank or drug like this, no, you do not open the door, okay? There's tape on the peephole. The blinds are shut, sealed tight. No light can escape. I was like a black hole. And I would be in that room alone sometimes and go like this, shh, you know, thinking I heard something, you know, just because I was so afraid of reality coming in. But that night, something strange happened. I went over and I opened the door without even looking. And I thought about it after I got sober. Why did I do that? Why did that happen? And I realized now why, because I had nothing left to lose. I didn't have anything to hide anymore. I had surrendered to being who I was. There was a freedom in knowing this is who you are. It's over. The fight's over. You lost. You're done. Now, I knew the problem, but I didn't know the solution. But until you know the problem, and that's why step one is so important, why all this talk about hitting bottom, Bill says. Well, that's why, because it's so important that we find out what the problem is, because you won't be willing to do the solution until you know what that's what the problem is. You're going to die. And now, and here's what happened. I opened that motel room door, and God walked in that. Now, he was short, fat, and bald. He looked a lot like my younger brother. And now I didn't know it was God. Now, and I believe that he said the only thing that I would have heard. It was divinely inspired. And I didn't know that at the time. He didn't come in there and lecture me. He didn't come in there and say, look what you're doing to your son, or try and lay a guilt trip on me. But I could see the horror in his eyes of my life. For the first time, I saw what my life looked like through someone else's eyes. Utter failure in every department of my life. And all he did was lay a phone number down on a table. He said, here's my number. And this was the only thing he said, and I believe it was the flimsy reed. It was the last cord of morals, the only thing that attached me to reality. He said, if you want, I will watch your son while you get help. See, I had just surrendered to die. And I didn't want my son to come with me. And I thought, thank God, I'll be able to save my son, get him off the ship, it's sinking. So on September 12th, 1990, that's how my sobriety date happened. I made that phone call and he came and got me. Now I learned a neat trick in AA. Did you ever notice that when you're out there, you can be the biggest dirtbag in the world, be the biggest drunk, everybody in the world's mad at you. And the problem with everybody in the world hating you is by the time you get to that, you don't like you either. And so what happened was, the moment you say, I'll get help, all of a sudden everybody loves you. Oh, we're so proud of you. You're gonna, and they all support you. What a neat trick. Thank God I didn't know that before, right? We see it over and over and over again with the new folks. But I said, okay, I'll get help. I didn't really want help, but I wanted him to take my boy. and bring and take him out of this life, because I was about to get really bad. So I figured, all right, let me go through with this bluff. I'll look for a treatment center. I'm looking for the Betty Ford Center. I want the Olympic pool, the weight room. I want the get a little sun. I didn't know anything about AA. I'd never met any of you. Didn't know where to find you if you were there. But I had heard about treatment. There were a couple of rock stars out there that had gotten sober, were playing music. Okay, I heard it was 30 days. I can do 30 days, or at least I'll enroll, you know, like I enrolled in college. I don't have to go, but I'll enroll. And unfortunately, the Betty Ford Centers don't take indigents. I finally found a place. It was an old apartment building in the hood, because I used to buy crack around the corner from it, that the United Way had converted into a treatment center. And they took me in. They had a bed, and it was a 6-month treatment center. Now, I'm not doing 6 months. I'm a bright guy. There's times I still look around. I go, I'm the smartest guy in the room. I'm just having a hard time proving it. Okay. My life proves that I'm not the smartest guy in the room. The number one symptom of insanity is you don't know you have it, right? People in the insane asylum thinks he's Jesus. Everybody else knows we're not, except for us. We're the last people to know it. And what I was the oldest guy in the treatment center. That's what I was. And I remember trying to impress the young guys. Do you know why? I used to own a bar on South Beach. I'm Miami Joe. They used to call me Miami Joe. Nobody called me Miami Joe. I called me Miami Joe. You are really pitiful when you got to give yourself a nickname, okay? So I remember the first night, it was my 40th birthday. It took me 5 days for them to find a bed available for me to go into this treatment center. And I finally get a bed on September 17th. While that 5 days was on, I remember my brother must have known somebody at his work that was in AA, and they called the house and they said, and it was a woman. She said, my name is so-and-so and I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to go to an AA meeting? I went, no, thank you. I'm going to get treatment. I didn't know what they treat you. I don't know how they do what they do, whether they give you a suppository or a pill or whatever it is, but I'm going to get treatment. But I'm proud of you. You keep going to those things, that AA, you know? And so I finally get in there on my 40th birthday. Thought it was the worst day of my life. One more thing I was wrong about. It was the turning point. And I remember that first night like it was yesterday. I'm standing outside that night with some other people. We were outside smoking. We were real men. We didn't vape back then. We smoked. And we were standing outside smoking, and this young guy pulls up, and I got to know him. He was 27 years old. He gets out of the car. Nice new car. It was a Friday night in Miami. What is this guy doing here on a Friday night in Miami? Miami's one of the greatest towns in the world on Friday night. And he gets out of the car, and he's got creased pants on. He's got a collared shirt, and he's dressed really nice. And his car is nice. I remember it was a Nissan Altima. Thought, man, you know, they always say in AA, if you want what we have, well, he had what I wanted. He had a full pack of Marlboro Reds and a watch. If I could have got my hands on those, I'd have been gone. Okay. And I didn't know what he was doing there. But I'm so delusional. I'm thinking, I wonder what they're paying this guy. I figured he's there to bring a counseling session in. I wonder what they're paying him. I bet I could do this gig. So he brings us in, and we're sitting around, and I say, I don't recognize it's an AA meeting, because I've never been to one. Don't know anything about it. And he said a couple things that I didn't believe in he said, you never have to take another drink or drug again. And, you know, as long as you want to. And I said, that's not true. But he said something else that got my attention. He said, you never have to feel the way you feel tonight again. And there were 50 people in this treatment center, homeless people. And I would have traded lives with anyone in there. Today, I wouldn't trade my life for anybody's. He also said something else. And as he started to share, he said, at the end of 6 months, there won't be 5 of you left. And he was right. There were only 2 of us. He said, but if you stay, your life will never be the same. Told the truth. I never saw that guy except for at the meetings a couple more times in that treatment center. And then he said the thing that really got my attention. He said, I graduated from this treatment center 2 years ago. And he had 2 years sober. And I thought, how do you get 2 years sober? And at the end of 6 months, they tried to throw me out a few times. I'm one of those guys that, you know, runs around complaining about everything. He's touching me. She's touching me. You know, one of those guys. You get there, you're miserable. Your life is over. You know how these people are in treatment. Anybody go to treatment centers? You know how it is. They're so miserable. So you can't, there's no laughs in the detox. But after about a week, they start to feel better and they come down. Good morning, family. Everything's wonderful again, right? They're at summer camp. That's what happened to me. I was at summer camp. This is great. They're feeding me. They're, you know, you go to their classes. There's girls in there. So I thought, you know, I can do this for a while. Well, at the end of 6 months, I got out of there. But I'm going to tell you what really, if there was this butterflies in my stomach the day I graduated from that treatment center, because I didn't want to drink again, but I wonder how long this will last. Wonder how long before I screw up. See, I always screw up. I'm a screw up. And I got out of that treatment center. I went where every good 40-year-old alcoholic goes. Mom, I'm home. I didn't go back to my girlfriend because she never did get sober. She was using, my parents set her up in an apartment and they had a place that they used to come down from. I grew up in Niagara Falls and they would come down and spend their winters in Central Florida. It was a retirement community. It's really not Florida. It's like South Georgia. It's the elephant burial ground. You have to be 1,000 years old to live in this place. And it was a manufactured home community. And if you don't know what a manufactured home is, it's kind of halfway between a house and a trailer. I used to call it Mom's Halfway House. And I remember, you know, it was close to where they had set my girlfriend up in an apartment and with my son. And I could see my son whenever I wanted to. And shortly afterwards, I got custody of my son because she went out and the police arrested her. And she's been in and out and in and out ever since and in and out of jails. God bless her. So I'm living with Mom. And my first night back in that trailer, I remember the date, March 23rd, 1991. I'm sitting out on the front stoop smoking cigarettes. And the guy next door is this old man watering his lawn. And I can see him kind of sliding over while he's watering his lawn. And he introduces, hey, my name's Frank. I said, hi, Frank. I'm Joe. Oh, you're Kay's son. Yeah, yeah. And he says, I hear you had some trouble with alcohol. Oh, Mom's been talking. And yes, Frank, but I'm sober now. And he says, would you like to go to an AA meeting? And I said, well, let me think. It's either stay home and watch Murder, She Wrote with Mom, or go to an AA meeting. I'll take the AA meeting, all right? He says, I'll pick you up at 6:45. Now, I'm going to describe something that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's who we really are. See if you recognize it. At 6:45, that man was sitting outside, that old guy. And let me tell you how old he was. He was 5 years younger than I am today. That's how old he was. And he was sitting outside in his car, just idling. He never rang the bell. He never came and knocked on the door. He never beeped the horn. He just sat there patiently waiting. I got out and we got into his car and we drove off to a meeting. I smoked his cigarettes, used up his gas. We got to the AA meeting. There were probably 50 people there. They were 1,000 years. You couldn't put together a whole set of teeth at this meeting. People were going, if you want what we have, I don't want a thing you have. I wouldn't even drink with you people. If I walked into a bar and you were there, I would have turned around and went to another place. But I remember this voice echoing in my head saying, these people are so lucky I'm desperate or I wouldn't be here. I didn't know that's how it works. That you have that gift of desperation we talk about, because you won't do this unless you're desperate. And we drove back home. And I remember the next night I was having dinner with my mom and I looked over her shoulder and there's that little car sitting outside idling at 6:45. And I thought, well, I missed the part about us going steady. And I was a little disturbed. But I got up and I went out and I got in a car and we drove off to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, in case you don't know what that is, the kindness of strangers, it's called unconditional love. And I'll bet a lot of you are here tonight because of the kindness of a stranger who welcomed you, who reached out to you. I see a lot of people's heads nodding. This is an incredible thing. And I didn't recognize it then, I do now. And I learned Alcoholics Anonymous on the front seat of that car. We went to a meeting. Frank had me on the circuit. Every night we went to a meeting, I said, don't you take any nights off, Frank? God, what about Monday night football? And there weren't a lot of meetings there in Central Florida. And there was one meeting on Tuesday night. He would drive to Ocala. It was an hour away and an hour back. And I'm going to, oh my God, riding a car with this old guy, an hour up, hour back. And Frank worked at Intergroup answering the phone. So we always would be picking up some new guy, right? We'd always have some other new guy in the car. And we'd be listening to this guy bellyache. I'd think, oh my God. But he had a way of inspiring me to go to the meetings I didn't want to go to. I remember he told me about this meeting. He said, oh, you're going to love this meeting. There's a lot of ex-strippers there. Really? Okay, I'll go with you. Now, he didn't tell me they were all 80 years old. But when you're living in Central Florida, they start to look good, okay? And I could be a big shot with an 80-year-old. And, so, yes, yeah, some are sicker than others. So, but Frank helped me understand this program. He taught me step one and step two. And if you read the book is nothing more than step one and step two repeated over and over and over again. Here's the problem. Here's the solution. And over the two alternatives, die an alcoholic death, live by spiritual principles. He tells you the problem, gives you the answer. Well, Frank told me, he said, listen, you're a smart guy. Because you don't understand. I'm Miami Joe. He was throwing a bar on South Beach. And he would say, you know, you're a really bright guy. And he says, I'm going to explain step one in a language you can understand. He said, step one is you're screwed. I go, he said, that's it. You're screwed. If you're not 100% convinced you'll drink again, you'll drink again. I went, whoa. And I thought about it. I said, well, Frank, that's terrible. He goes, yep, step one's bad news. He said, if that's the friggin' case, and it sounds like it's going to take a miracle. He said, yes, that's step two. And that's exactly what we have here. It's a miracle. If I could have stopped on my own, I would have stopped on my own. And I didn't understand that all those years I was treating my alcoholism. Think about it. If you got a drinking problem, and what's the logical solution? Don't drink. Well, why didn't that work for us? And here's the reason. I was treating my drinking like pretending to be a non-alcoholic. I would come to full of guilt, shame, and remorse, and I would say, that's it. I'm going to get a job, straighten my life out, pay my bills, be a dad. Well, if I could have done those things, I would have done those things. I don't understand the illness. I don't understand that I will drink again. It's in Fred, the accountant. It says, my friends prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the day would come when I would drink again. Apart from divine help, I will drink again. So I didn't come to God for some religious fervor. I came to God because I had failed. Self-will had failed me. I started doing things what Frank would told me to pray. I started praying when I didn't believe in prayer. I started doing things I didn't believe in, going to these meetings, hanging out with these old people, doing these steps, taking inventories, showing up at these places and doing these things. Now, I remember my first trip through the steps was pretty feeble, I'll be honest. But here's the good news for you if you're new. I don't care how feeble of an attempt you do at these steps, it will have an effect. Even if it carries you to your next trip through the steps. That's the good news for us. I did a fourth step and it wasn't a causes and conditions. It was more of a conditions. I didn't realize then that you can fix the conditions, but if you don't take care of the causes, the conditions return. And what happened to me was things started happening in my life. You know, it's amazing when you don't drink and don't commit felonies on a daily basis, your life gets better. Started to get better. I started to get promoted at work. At that time, I was selling cars. I know it's hard to believe. I'm a recovering car salesman. But at that time, I was selling cars. And what happened was Frank worked at Intergroup, and he would come back and he would tell me about this girl that answered the phones at Intergroup. And I fell in love with this girl long before I met her. It was boy meets girl on AA campus. She was, and he would tell me how beautiful she was. And I thought this was going to be okay. And I was 2 years sober at this time. And I thought, you know, the relationship's sanctioned by the Pope, Frank, you know, so it should be good. And, but I became an AA stalker. I ended up meeting her and we fell madly in love. And you could hear the suction in the room. And when we were in the same room together, and I would go to meetings looking for her. I would go to this meeting, peek through the windows. If she wasn't there, I'd go to another meet. Well, she had two kids and I had my son and we ended up getting married. It was a big AA wedding and everything was wonderful. But here's the problem. It, what happened to me, my life started to get so much better that I started worshiping the gifts instead of the giver. And I started to get attached to all these things that were coming to me. This beautiful woman, this great job, more money. I got my credit back, got rid of the IRS. I hadn't paid income tax in 20 years when I got here. I paid the IRS off. I mean, my life is absolutely proof. These are the promises coming true. Those are all material things. They are not the promises coming true. They're a side effect, okay? And I get this job offer, this huge job offer, way back running this huge car dealership, a luxury dealership down in South Florida. And I said, this is the chance of a lifetime. This is the promises coming true. And I dragged that little family against everybody's, my sponsor, against everybody's, even my wife, Tammy, against her wishes. And I dragged that family down to South Florida and I take this job. Now, I learned a lot. And I started working 12, 14 hours a day, 6 and 7 days a week. If you're working 12, 14 hours a day, 6, 7 days a week, you're not qualified for the job you're doing. It's, you're just running around being busy. And that's what I was doing. And I was really busy. And I stopped going to meetings. I stopped working the program of alcohol. I was just too busy. And what happens is the, it says on page 61, the alcoholic insanity returns and we drink again. The insanity was on me. And I don't know. There's no warning sign. There's no sign. You're going crazy. You're going to drink. Well, what happened was I started doing things because I don't drink first. I start behaviors. I started doing things, the dishonesty, the deceit, the hiding money. I'm planning for the breakup of my relationship just in case this thing doesn't work out. And you know what? When you got 1 foot in, 1 foot out, and after about a year, and I'm going home and I think I'm fooling them. I'm putting a cardboard cutout of a husband up. And I think I'm fooling my wife because I'm tired. And I just checking boxes. I put a cardboard cutout of a dad up for the kids. Think I'm fooling them and I'm not fooling anybody. And I come home one night after about a year being married. And she said, I want a divorce. Now, if you're, I run a business now and I have hundreds of employees. And I tell them, if you're surprised when you get fired, you deserve to be fired. I was surprised when she asked me for a divorce. I was, look, what? I mean, I don't know. I'm so clueless. And as I leave that house, and by the way, if you're the one leaving the house, it's not your house. Okay. It wasn't my house. So I'm leaving that house with my little boy in tow. And she says something to me that I didn't hear at the time, but later on it came to haunt me. She said, can't you see all your relationships end the same? I would have saw that if I did a causes and conditions fourth step, but I didn't. And I'm enraged and I leave that house. And I'm so enraged that I'd start, and I'm broke because you're not prepared. I'm never prepared. I start applying for credit cards to pay off credit cards, bad financial plan. And then I'm so enraged it affects my job. And probably within 2 months, they fire me from the best job I ever had. Now I'm 6 years sober and I've lost my job. I'm divorced and I'm in debt up to my eyeballs. And by the way, when we got divorced, she got custody of AA. So I can't go to those meetings that she goes to because they're going to say, what a nut this guy is. He's a dirtbag. How could you ever do anything? She's the sweetest girl in the world. And so I'm going to meetings. I don't know anybody. I'm hitting a different meeting whenever I go. And one day it happens. I drive by a bar. And then the name caught my attention. It said Bar. and it's got the parking lot in the back, and it opens at 8 a.m. And I said, I can be a big shot in there. I can be Miami Joe in that bar. And, but it's hard to drink when you got 6 years sober. See, there's one thing that had happened. I had unworked all the steps except step one, part A. I knew that if I take a drink, my lifestyle is going to change. And I would drive by that bar. I drove by that bar every day for 7 days. And finally on day seven, my little boy was asleep in the back room of that furnished apartment. And I cursed God. At this point, I'm not eating, I'm not sleeping, I'm so angry. And I cursed God and I said, if this is sobriety, you can have it. And I drove across town and I didn't care. I said, I'm going to drink tonight. And if I drank, I probably wouldn't have come home to my son. And this is a true story. I'm one block away from the bar and I'm at a traffic light and it's dark out. And over here on the side street is a street light. And it's shining down on a broken down old van with its hood up. And the front license plate on the van, I could read it in the street light. It said, have you prayed today? And like an idiot, I said the serenity prayer. And I didn't go into the bar that night. I drove back across town. It was almost like a sober blackout to a meeting I'd been to one time a year earlier. I walked into this meeting and I sat in the back. And there was about 150 people at this meeting at this church. And the man at the podium was saying, tonight's anniversary night. We're celebrating anniversaries. Does anybody else here have an anniversary in the month of September? And like an idiot, I raised my hand. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, I'll go to treatment. Oh, then everybody loves you, right? Everybody claps for me. He says, here's what we do at this meeting. We have about five or six celebrants. They all come up and share about 5-10 minutes how they stayed sober. Since we have a visitor, why don't you start us off? Oh my God. And as you can tell, I really have very rarely been at a loss for words, but I walked up to from the back of the room and I got to the podium and I turned around. And what I saw was your faces. And I couldn't talk. All I could do was cry. And then I stood there sobbing. And no sound, and it seemed like eternity. And I just stood there sobbing. And it was my 6-year anniversary. And finally, two men came and rushed me off the stage. And they took me back in the kitchen. Now, I know why they rushed me off the stage. The treatment center brought the van and the front row was all newcomers, right? I could hear them. That's not how it is at 6 years sober. He's just humble. You know, no, that's not what it was like. But those two guys, the kindness of strangers, one more time. They stayed with me till 11:30 at night. They knew I was angry and fragile. And then they picked me up at 7:30 the next morning and they dragged me around with them. I had 3 meetings with them the next day. And it's like the old joke, we're going to show you how to do this one more time. They got me involved in the steps again. They got me involved in sponsorship and sponsoring and going into taking meetings into detoxes and treatment centers in prison. And I do all of that every week now. And these guys were a lifesaver to me. And what happened was, is that I had a second awakening. I had a second surrender in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized I did this stone cold sober. I couldn't blame my failure on alcohol and drugs again. I had to own it. And I went through the steps at a level I had never gone through before. And I did a searching and fearless moral inventory. A causes and conditions fourth step. And I did a sixth and seventh that were unlike anything before, and they were freedom. And I discovered, it's like Bill says in step six, he says, and I asked my newfound friend to take away my defects root and branch. And in six and seven, I discovered, see, I didn't need God. I needed a loving God because I would just obey a God, but I won't do it forever. I needed a loving God. And I discovered him that second trip through the steps. And there was no more separation of church and state. There wasn't my drinking, my AA life, my work life, my married life, my financial life. There was only my recovery. And before I used to plan my recovery around my life and my life pushed AA out. Now I plan my life around my recovery. It's the number one, it's all around my recovery. And things changed in my life. I became willing for the first time in my life, I made a decision based on someone else's welfare, my son. I couldn't go back to the car business because the hours were too demanding and I was a single parent now. And my sponsor said, why don't you take a crummy job? Why don't you just take a job where you can take your son to school in the morning and pick him up from school at night. And I became willing to do it, not with a lot of joy in my heart, but I became willing to do that. And I was scared. I was 47 years old. But the good news is that this failure helped me realize I'm not going to be discovered. I always thought I was going to be discovered. I don't know for what. And I'm never going to be president of GM. I'm not going to own my own car dealership. And I knew, you know what? Maybe I can just be a good dad. And he said, maybe you can be a good member of AA too. I said, I might be able to do those two things. And I learned how to be a dad at 6.5, 7 years sober. I picked my son up, took him to school every day. We had dinner at home every night. I made stir fry. It's all I knew how to make. One night it was chicken. One night it was beef. But we had dinner together every night. We used to play tackle football in a living room with no furniture. And it was one of the best years of his life. That little boy is not sober today. He's out there. And he's had some terrible things happen to him out on the streets. And my heart is broken. I'm in touch with him over and over. And there's nothing more heartbreaking than know you cannot get, I can't go give him $100 bill because it'll bring him closer to his death. And I want to. And I just talked to him just the other day. But that little boy, one of the trips in treatment, he said, they asked him, what was the fondest memory you have in your life? He said, that year with my dad and I, it was the greatest time of my life. I learned to be a dad. I coached him in Little League, in baseball, basketball, football. I got to give all those promises that I made. They happened in my life. And then I took my job, and my attitude about money changed. I didn't care about money. And you're not going to believe this. I didn't even have a cell phone. This was 1997. I didn't even have a cell phone back then because I couldn't afford it. But we did things on the weekend that were free. We went to the beach. We went to the parks. We played baseball. I coached him in all these sports. I became willing to take a crummy job. And in the 11th step, it talks about bringing, or 10 and 11, it talks about bringing, in the 12th step, bringing this spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous into our work. And I tried it. I took this crummy job and it brought the spirit of recovery into my work. And I'm going to tell you the craziest thing that happened. I fell in love with that crummy job. And I have never worked a day in my life since. True story. And it's become a passion. And it's become a gift. And then a year and a half later, my wife and I ran into each other at a conference similar to this, an AA conference. She had thrown herself back into her steps. I had thrown myself. I didn't throw myself into a relationship to get over a relationship. I wasn't, you know, we didn't have Facebook and Tinder. You know, if you can scroll through these pages, you'll see everybody's Tinder profile picture up on the last page. God bless you. They're out there trolling for carbon. Luckily, I didn't have that. But what happened is we ran into each other at a conference and we started dating. We'd always loved each other. We just didn't know how to show it. And what we did is we both surrendered that if we're going to be in a relationship, we, as it says in the book, we have to be on a different basis. And we invited God into a relationship. And for the next, we'll celebrate 23 years married continuously next month. We got remarried. And every morning we take our own quiet time and then we pray together for our marriage. Because we need God's help. And here's another thing. And the worst parent in the world, the guy that should have been arrested, God saw fit to give me another chance. At 49 years old, I had twin boys. Those twin boys are now 22 years old. They are the greatest blessing in our life. At the time, we thought, oh my God, twins, what am I going to do? And one just graduated from the University of Miami. The other one runs one of our clinics in Greenville, South Carolina. And these boys are the apple of our eye. And they know they're loved. And they love us. They still take vacations with us. They love being around us. We have an incredible relationship with them. I wish my older son would do that. He can't come around because when he does, he steals. He doesn't know you can't steal what's free. This thing is free. But so my life is living proof that this program, it's living proof that there is a God, okay? Even though I wish I could tell you I walk around grateful. I should be, but I'm not always grateful. I'm blessed beyond my ability to be grateful. if you really want to know the truth. I'm going to tell you a quick story, and I'll end with this. There was a bar in Miami when I used to own my bar. My bar closed at 5 o'clock at night, and I would leave with my little entourage, you know, I was a pseudo big shot, and I would leave my little entourage, and we would go to this place. It was an after hours club. It was my favorite bar in the whole world. There was no sign. It was all blacked out windows. The limos would be double parked up and down the streets. The cops never went in. Everything in the world went on there. People would get shot, stabbed. They would throw out the stabby, not the stabber, you know, and you would go into the, you had to ring a doorbell. They'd slide a little door open. If they knew you, you would get in. If they didn't, you would. You'd go into this club. There would be 500 people, no windows. Greatest club. It was a disco. So for you young people, disco is a place where we used to go and dance. So you would go in here and it would be great. You'd be in your disco garb from Saturday night. You'd be, and everything. It was so much fun. Here's the problem. 11 o'clock in the morning, it closed. And they would open that door and you'd be on Miami Beach. And the sun would be shining and you'd be in your clothes for about 3 days. And they'd open that door. You go, oh my God, no. And it was like all the vampires pouring out of the bar. But here's why I loved it. They would give you a drink. Back then, we always drank when we drove. It's just the way Miami was. They would give you what they called a roadie, a full glass. And I drank scotch at the time. By the way, I invented the South Beach diet. Anybody hear of the South Beach diet? It's scotch and cocaine. So they would give me a full glass of scotch, right? And I would walk out and they would give you cardboard sunglasses. Oh my God, that was, thank you, Lord. What a lifesaver. And I remember one morning walking out of this bar. I got my cardboard 3D sunglasses on. I got my full glass of scotch and I got a Marlboro hanging from my, and I get in my car and I drive to the next light. And at this traffic light, it's Sunday morning, about 11 o'clock. And I look over next to me in this little car is a family. There's a man in a short sleeve white shirt with a tie on and his hair's combed, greased back. And next to him is his wife, her hair's all curled up. And it was an older car and she's in a dress, you know, and her hair is all curled up. And in the back seat is a little boy and a little girl dressed identical to the parents. Now it's Sunday morning. You know where they're coming from or going to. Okay. And I got my cardboard sunglasses, cigarette hanging out of my mouth, and I'm drinking my scotch. And I look over and I'm thinking, what a bunch of losers. And I'm sure the little boy in that car, he was staring at me. I'm sure he's going, look, Dad, the Antichrist. But today, because of the kindness of strangers, because of the unconditional love and a loving God that I found in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm in that car. I want to thank you for my life. Thanks.